Thank you. Good morning. The next case on our docket is 20-10615. Mr. Taylor.
If it may please the court, I represent Berman DePaz Gonzalez and Emerita Martinez Torres. This case is not a case about the right to government subsidized medical care. It's not about the right to medical care at all. It's a case about the right of or the prohibition against physicians, government physicians, state actors from committing passive euthanasia without the consent of their patients. That was not an issue that was addressed by the court below. Instead, the court below dismissed the case based on a perceived lack of standing that was not briefed by the parties. In this court, I believe all the parties are in agreement that the basis for the district court's ruling was an error. I'm happy to discuss that further if the court would like, but otherwise, I'll move on to the grounds, the alternate grounds that the appellees advance in order to request rather to have this court consider in order to affirm the district judge's dismissal. Loosely, they can be grouped into two categories. The first being whether there was a constitutional injury in this case. The second being, if so, who may be responsible. On the first one, again, the key issue, I think, is that this does not involve a right to medical care. We are not asking the court to hold that there is any right to medical care in any way. This is not a situation similar to the right to contraceptives cases or anything of that nature. Rather, this is a case about passive euthanasia, right to bodily integrity, the right to life, and even right to property. The sources of the constitutional injury stem from all three types protected by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. The life interest that is inherent in this case, that is recognized by cases such as the Supreme Court's Cruzan opinion, as well as Texas state courts construing that, such as the TL versus Cook Children's case. Second, and perhaps most obviously, there is a right to bodily integrity, the right to consent or refuse treatment that goes back for well over 100 years. That was recognized, and it was probably even more so than the life interest. It was this liberty interest, the liberty interest in bodily integrity that was most at issue in Cruzan and TL versus Cook, et cetera. But it also stems from state law by virtue of Supreme Court cases such as Vitek, that if a state in general, whether it be legislative or executive, if a state creates mandatory requirements for a state actor before it can do something, then those requirements are protected by the Constitution. The process itself is protected by procedural due process. So that's an issue we have here as well. We have mandatory requirements of the Texas Advanced Directive Act. It provides options for physicians, or for either patients or physicians and the patient surrogates, to cease life support if everyone agrees. But in the absence of agreement, Texas law prohibits a physician from unilaterally terminating life support. It is simply not a decision that a physician can make on his own, and that is the core issue here, because that's what happened in this case, that the termination decision was made without any process whatsoever. Third, there's actually a property interest involved here from cases such as Board of Regents versus Roth, the Supreme Court's opinion here. This was actually not addressed at all. This standard was not addressed by the appellees in any of their briefing. It does not require the mandatory substantive distinction. It simply requires a reasonable expectation that money, benefits, et cetera, will be provided. In this case, the Texas Advanced Directive Act created a reasonable expectation of minimal life support for a time period long enough for a patient's surrogates to seek alternate treatment. Time period to go through the process, as well as 10 days afterwards, time to to institute a guardian proceeding if needed in order to challenge it. In this case, none of that occurred.
You don't rely on the express terms of the 14th Amendment to life, the due process?
Yes, sir. We represented those both. First, as I said, the life interest is protected by the 14th Amendment itself, we believe was recognized in the Supreme Court's Cruzan opinion. Second, the liberty interest is recognized by both the 14th Amendment as recognized in Cruzan and as a product of state law itself as recognized in cases such as Vitek cited in our brief. Then the third, the property interest is created by state law. Property interests are always created by state law. They're not created by the Constitution itself, but once created by state law, they are protected by the 14th Amendment. So in the case of liberty interest, it's both inherent in the Constitution and from state law. The other two are the life interest is from the Constitution, the property interest is from state law. So there is no need for this court to consider whether there's any right to medical treatment. We're dealing with a much more limited situation, the right to minimal care, which is the right to nourishment, the right to liquids, the right to drink effectively, or in this case, from an IV. Here, in this case, we have the most fundamental right of all, the very right to breathe, the very breath of life itself. And as Judge O'Connor discussed in the Cruzan concurrence, this type of thing is inherent in a person's bodily integrity. She discussed the feeding tubes, but there's no difference between feeding tubes and ventilation tubes. They both involve the physical insertion of a tube into a person's body. And the removal of that tube is no less intrusive than the insertion of the tube in the first place, particularly when the intended effect of that removal is to cause death by suffocation. And it amazes me that, in fact, the appellants in this case take the position that there is no constitutional right created here. The next question, the second half of the issue, is then who is responsible or who may be responsible, rather, because we're simply at the pleading stage here before any opportunity for discovery, before any substantive positions taken by the appellants. But the issue we have here is two distinct issues. In the case of the individual appellee, Dr. Duane or Dr. Duwani, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the issue is straightforward. If, in fact, there was a constitutional injury, there's no question the allegations show she was a moving force behind that injury. She's individually liable, or potentially maybe individually liable. She's at least, the claims against her are not subject to dismissal at the pleading stage. The issues in terms of who is responsible really deal with the corporate and governmental defendants, Acclaim and John Peter Smith Hospital, which I'll refer to as JPS. The appellees argue that they may not be liable regardless of the constitutional injury because we haven't sufficiently alleged a policy that was a moving force. This issue has been simplified significantly by the briefing in this case. At the outset in the court below in the initial briefing, much of the discussion revolved around whether Dr. Guane was herself a policymaker, whether she was able to set policies for her department as a department head. It identified numerous alternative theories, but all of them came down to the situation that this was not a surreptitious termination by a doctor creeping into the room at night and pulling a plug out of the wall or fighting past nurses who were objecting to the termination of this patient's life. Rather, it was pursuant to an order by Dr. Duwani that was accepted as valid by all the nurses in this case, the other doctors, et cetera, and that similar things had happened on multiple occasions, at least three, perhaps as many as 10 within a single month, or at least that's what the allegations say. So regardless of whether this was a formal policy or not, or an unofficial policy, a delegation to Dr. Duwani as a policymaker, custom, et cetera, there's enough at the initial pleading stage to believe that discovery would reveal that there was an official policy of Acclaim and JPS, regardless of how that was conveyed. However, in the course of briefing, in the course of the responses, the issue has been simplified because both Acclaim and JPS contend that there is no obligation for them to follow the Texas Advance Directives Act or to provide any due process before termination at all. You can look at this in the sections discussing discussing the VITEC claims that I referred to before, the effect of state law on constitutional protections. In the claims, that was, I think, section B, 2, and 3 of their brief. I do not recall the section of JPS's brief, but both of them say essentially the same arguments. JPS argues that the provisions of the Texas Advance Directives Act are optional, that they are merely safe harbor provisions and do not impose any obligations on doctors at all. They further argue that, again, that there is no constitutional protection against unilateral termination of patients by a state physician. Okay. A claim goes further. If you read section B2 and 3 of their brief, they actually argue that the Texas Advance Directive Act at all does not provide any mandatory provisions at all. They argue that, in fact, unless a physician first certifies that a patient is terminal or not capable of recovery, then a physician doesn't have to follow any of the regulations in the act. If I understand their position correctly, and you may read this for yourselves, if their position is accepted, it would mean a physician could simply ignore the act and do perhaps what might be called an end around simply by failing to follow the first obligation and not certify a patient as terminal. More ominously, if they're correct on that, if the act doesn't apply at all, and if there's no constitutional protections unless and until a physician decides certifies a patient as terminal, then they could very well be no constitutional protection or state law protection against the withdrawal of life support for a patient who is expected to recover. That's huge, because some level of life support, air, fluids, are essential to all types of surgeries and other medical procedures in which a patient is fully expected to recover after a certain period of time if the operation is successful. This cannot be a position accepted by this court, as it would essentially remove all constitutional or state law protections for patients at any governmental hospital at any level. There is one other issue that bears mentioning on this, and that's the slight distinction between a claim and JPS. JPS would be liable for the reasons I mentioned, that the official policy as represented to this court is apparently that neither the Constitution nor the Texas Advance Directive Act provides any mandatory requirements on its physicians. And it's quite likely that we will find a formal written policy to that effect, but at least we'll expect that discovery would lead to other evidence of the absence of a policy, custom, et cetera, that would provide liability. For a claim, however, the situation is different, but because the Supreme Court, going back to Pembauer, this court, and Jett, have recognized that this issue is determined by state law. And there's no logical reason for applying municipal policy cases, the policymaker standard, to corporations, a corporation that has been delegated the authority to run a hospital. Instead, regardless of whatever the court decides on any other issue, it should clarify this particular issue to establish the standard that private corporations, or at least corporations, whether public, private, nonprofit, et cetera, to clarify the standard that they are subject to for the purposes of determining whether they are a person under Monell, whether an act of a particular director, officer, et cetera, is in fact the act of the corporation itself versus merely respondeat superior liability. That's an issue that will grow as more and more government functions are shifted to corporations. And so regardless of any other issues the court decides, that's something that would be beneficial, I think, to cases going forward, to get resolution on that standard. And if state corporate law applies, then the applicable standard is vice principal liability described in Fort Worth Elevator, Hammerly, et cetera, and that is found in both of our briefs. I see that my time is almost up. I'm happy to answer any other questions. Otherwise, I'll reserve the remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Vickers.
May it please the court. Thank you for being hearing us today. I want to begin by expressing my sympathy for the family of the appellants. It's always tragic when a patient has to be placed on life support, and even more tragic when one is faced with a decision to withdraw life support. Of course, I'll be speaking about and addressing issues related to Dr. Duane and to a claim. And I will also address two questions discussed by Mr. Taylor a moment ago. One, whether the Texas Advanced Directives Act gives rise to a constitutionally protected interest, and whether the appellants actually pled such a claim. Now, Mr. Garrett, who's here on behalf of JPS Hospital, will respond separately on the questions related to JPS and whether there is a due process right to continued medical care outside of the Advanced Directives Act. Now, of course, we're here today on the 12B6 motions, and the primary question before the court is whether the complaint pleads facts establishing 1983 claims against Dr. Duane and the two entities that allow the court to infer a plausible right to relief. The appellants asked the court, however, to find numerous inferences in the complaint's threadbare 1983 allegations that are simply not supported by the complaint. Now, the appellees pointed out the deficiencies in the appellant's brief pleading in the trial court below, and they did not take the opportunity, as they had a right, to amend their complaint. And so we're here on the original complaint, which I asked the court, urge you to look at. And based on that complaint, the court can affirm for any of several reasons. To begin, without having to reach the constitutional questions posed, the court can affirm based solely on the adequacy of the 1983 allegations against the appellees. Alternatively, as I will argue, there is no claim for violation of due process based on a failure to follow the Advanced Directives Act. And no claim has been pled. So to begin with Dr. Duane, the appellants impliedly concede that their complaint did not make clear they were bringing claims against Dr. Duane in anything but her corporate or official capacity. And that's shown by the fact they rely so heavily on a course of proceedings argument. Of course, this court's opinion in Adrian versus Regents of the University of California, cited in page 16 of our brief, is on all fours. It's a case where the court noted the plaintiff's pleading was unclear on whether the individual employees were sued in official or individual capacities. The defendants moved to dismiss under 12B6, saying that they were only named in their official capacities, and the plaintiffs did not respond to that allegation or correct it in their response. That is exactly what happened here. In fact, after—
yeah, that case said it was unnecessary to specifically allege whether the defendant is sued individually or officially. Isn't that right?
It did, but it also said that where it is unclear whether the defendant was sued individually or officially, then you would look to the proceedings. And here, it was unclear. That's easy to see just by looking at the two pages where the complaint is stated out. The word defendants is referred to as having employees. It talks about a hospital degree of liability. The only time Dr. Duane is mentioned, or you can assume an individual is being sued, is where she's stated, defined as a decision maker. So it was just absolutely unclear. And we stated that in our initial motion, and the defendants didn't even respond at all to the 1983 motion to dismiss as to Dr. Duane.
Well, the plaintiff in their briefing, though, I know this was in to the state law claim when the argument was made that there was no cause of action. Plaintiffs answered that argument by saying that they have alleged the allegations against Dr. Duane in her individual capacity. So aren't we entitled to look at the briefing too as part of the proceedings?
We absolutely believe so. But if you look at the briefing, the statement that the appellants refer to is stated in a section arguing on the 12B1 motion on the state law claims. What's critical is that the argument that Dr. Duane made was in a specific section on the 1983 claims. And the briefing below didn't address that response at all. In fact, I think what this actually shows is that the plaintiffs knew that if they needed to clarify whether a claim is made against Dr. Duane in her individual or official capacity, they could do that. They did it in the state law claims, and it's perfectly reasonable to say we're going to sue her solely in her individual capacity on the state law claims and choose, for example, on the 1983 claims to only try and challenge the hospitals. And what's really clear is that the hospital and the claim were the target of the appellant's briefing. The claims against Dr. Duane,
you're saying that the plaintiff is saying that her capacity would differ depending on whether you look at the 1983 action or the state law claims, it varies. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying it's possible. And whenever we pointed out that it did not appear the 1983 claim was asserted against Dr. Duane in her individual capacity at all, the plaintiffs did not respond. They could have simply had a section that says, no, we're suing her in her individual capacity. There's no response to the 1983 allegations against Dr. Duane at all in the response brief. And so that is our argument. But even assuming, as to the corporate liability, so putting that aside, to allege corporate liability, the plaintiffs also had to show an official policy and the corporate policymaker. Now, of course, they haven't alleged an actual policy. They only allege some sort of custom or widespread practice. But this court's decisions make clear that to allege such a custom or widespread practice, the facts alleged can't be conclusory and they must contain specific facts. I'd like to point the court to Pena versus City of Rio Grande City, cited at page 43 of our brief. In that case, the court held that where the only specific fact pleaded to allege a policy or custom is the single incident where the plaintiff was involved, that is insufficient to plausibly plead a practice so persistent and widespread as to have the force and effect of law. So here, that's all. The only specific fact pleaded was the one relating to Mr. DePaz. Lacking those specific facts.
Didn't Leatherman say that you don't have to plead with particularity on this point?
Well, the issue isn't whether or not there is. I think the real question, and this again going back to Pena, which is not 2018.
But that is what Leatherman said, is it not?
Well, you don't have to. I think the issue here is not whether or not you had to plead all the facts of particularity. You had to allege something from which it's plausible to infer a practice or custom. And at a minimum,
he does have some pretty specific allegations.
Well, actually, what the appellants have made are allegations about allegations. They don't even make the allegations of additional conduct themselves. They allege someone else, an advocacy group, and an anonymous email have made allegations. And
so this is on the pleadings. I mean, there's been no discovery, and it's not a summary judgment. So we've got cases saying that when it's a 12B6, you cut the plaintiff some slack until he's been able to conduct some discovery.
Well, we do think that I agree that it this is only a 12B6 standard, but they have not even pleaded any sort of practice that you could assume is widespread. In fact, there are inferences that one might draw to the opposite of what the plaintiffs have pleaded based on the fact that in addition to saying that Dr. Duane did withdrew life support maybe three times in a month, they also allege that that conduct was immediately reported by others, according to nurses or something, nurses to Dr. Ely, who is the chair of the hospital, and that they also allege that Dr. Duane was removed. So instead of giving rise to an inference of a policy or custom that's so widespread to have the force of law, those statements, allegations made in the plaintiff's complaint and the attachments actually yield an opposite inference, that it was not a policy or custom. And at most,
well, you only had multiple nurses and doctors participated in the involuntary termination of life support. They got that email from a resident who presumably had personal knowledge of it. I mean, how much more do they need to allege?
Well, the resident's email actually contradicts the allegation of a widespread practice. It says it was only three incidences and only within 1 month, and that all of those instances were reported. So for purposes of corporate liability, that is just not enough to hold the entire acclaimed physician group or the hospital liable. That's really the question here, is corporate liability for an individual's acts. And those facts just shouldn't give rise, or don't give rise, we believe, under this court's law to that. If there are any other, I see I'm near the end of my 10 minutes, and so Mr. Garrett will take over in a minute. I just want to note that under the Texas Advanced Directives Act, it is not mandatory. And the TL case, I want to point out, page 26 of the TL case plainly states the Advanced Directives Act gives immunity. That's its function. So you have state law claims, but you have a right to challenge those claims if brought against you, if you follow the act. And if there are no other questions, I'll yield to Mr.
Why wouldn't there be some procedure due, some due process required under the 14th Amendment, whether it's Texas Act or whether it's just a federal standard of due process?
Well, on those questions, I've actually, Mr. Garrett and I have prepared where he would be prepared to answer those questions. So I'm happy to yield to him for that and for your answer to that question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Garrett.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Garrett. I represent the Tarrant County Hospital District doing business as JPS Health Network. First of all, thank you very much for hearing us today. We ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment and dismissal the appellant's Section 1983 claim for three reasons. The first is that the complaint does not allege a violation of the 14th Amendment due process right. The second is that the complaint fails to identify an official policy or custom of JPS. And three, the complaint does not identify a final policymaker of JPS or allege that such policymaker knew of or approved the policy or custom. And picking up with Judge Davis's questions to Mr. Vickers at the very end there, as the court knows, to state a claim under Section 1983, a plaintiff has to allege the violation of a right secured by the Constitution or the laws of the United States and demonstrate that a person acting under color of state law violated that right. With respect to Your Honor's first question, the complaint here does not allege a violation of the 14th Amendment due process right.
It alleges no due process, which was the violation.
I'm sorry,
Judge. It does allege no due process. There was no process given, is what the complaint says.
They do allege that in very conclusory fashion, Judge. When you look at the complaint itself, what they specifically state in their complaint is that the failure of the appellees, JPS, Acclaim, and Dr. Duane, that their failure to adhere to the Texas Advanced Directives Act was the direct violation of Mr. DePaz's due process rights under the 14th Amendment. And so the way this claim has been pled down below is that the failure to follow a state statute, the Advanced Directives Act, was the violation of Mr. DePaz's due process rights. That's what's in their complaint. Now, in our motion to dismiss at the trial court level, we address the reasons why the Advanced Directives Act does not provide a federally guaranteed or constitutional right that would be subject to due process. We address that and brief that down below in the motion to dismiss. Now, on appeal, the appellants want to pivot a little bit, and they want to now assert that there was a deprivation of Mr. DePaz's substantive due process right to life under the 14th Amendment. The issue there is that the issue as framed by the appellants presumes that there is a constitutional right to medical care possessed by all citizens. And the 14th Amendment simply does not provide a constitutional right to Medicare, to medical care.
Well, it does provide due process right to life.
It does, Judge. And when you look at the cases, we see that in a constitutional sense, there was nothing that JPS, Acclaim did that deprived Mr. DePaz of his life. What the cases draw is a critical distinction between a situation where the state takes an affirmative act to deprive someone of life versus a situation where medical care is withdrawn. What the cases say in that situation is that the death is not caused by the withdrawal of the life care, the life-sustaining treatment, but rather the death is the natural result of the underlying disease or condition running its course. And so
are you referring to there?
The cases that we cite in our brief are the Vaco versus Quill case, which recognize that the intent of a physician that withdraws life-sustaining care is not to kill the patient, but to cease doing useless and futile or degrading things to the patient when he no longer stands to benefit from them. We've also cited the N. Ray Collier case, the N. Ray Guardianship of LW, and the Krischer versus McIver case. cases that recognize that there's a fundamental and legally distinct difference between depriving someone of life versus letting disease run its course. So the issue is,
when you pull a plug, you're not just letting it go its course, are you?
I think you are, Judge. You're no longer affirmatively taking actions to artificial actions to maintain life at that point. You're simply removing the medical care and allowing the natural disease or condition to run its course. Here in our situation, the natural disease or condition, rather, that was an issue, or the unfortunate consequences of the accident that Mr. DePaz was involved in, the death was caused by that underlying accident and the condition that resulted from that, not the withdrawal of life-sustaining care. And therefore, in a constitutional sense, there was no deprivation of life subject to the due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
That is only true if it's beyond doubt that life will cease if the support is withdrawn. Right? When you go on a heart-lung machine and they withdraw support prematurely, you're going to die, not because you had an open heart surgery, but because you've not been treated long enough to get well.
I think the way I would answer that, Chief Judge Owen, is that the underlying disease or condition, regardless of the circumstance, is the cause of the death, not the withdrawal of the life support. The state didn't put Mr. DePaz in the condition that it found him in when he was delivered to the hospital.
I'm just saying his condition may be different from others, but I don't think you can categorically say that in every case. My question presupposes that he's never going to recover from the underlying condition.
Correct. I understand that, Judge. My point there is that the withdrawal of the life support is not the triggering event that causes the death. It's rather allowing the underlying disease or condition to run its course. And that's the distinction.
That's only in cases where there's been a determination that there's no possibility of recovery.
I think that's in any case where you have an underlying disease or condition that can cause death.
Not that can cause death, but that will cause death without... unless life support is continued, but there's no possibility of recovery. That's my only point.
Okay. I want to make sure I fairly understood and answered your question, Judge. Is there any additional question you have for me there, Judge?
No, I just want to make sure that you're not saying the hospital can unilaterally withdraw life support without a determination by the hospital or someone that there is no possibility of recovery.
Fair enough, Judge. And my point here is simply that there is no constitutional right to continued medical treatment. There's no general right to constitutional medical care. In fact, the case law that interprets this, they do so in the context of prisoners or incapacitated persons who are involuntarily committed to the custody of the state. The fact that we have an exception for situations where an individual is affirmatively brought within the care or custody of the state, and that only in those situations there's medical care to be provided, that proves the general rule that there is no constitutional right to medical care under the Due Process Clause as a general matter. Now, with respect to the policy and policymaker points 2 and 3 of our argument, and going back to a question earlier that Judge Davis had, I would direct Your Honor to the Spiller case, a case out of the Fifth Circuit, when it comes to the issue of when is an official policy sufficiently pled. And Spiller, the court, very helpful case. It involved a Section 1983 claim in the Fourth Amendment context, whether an arrest was illegal. The district court in that case found, they dismissed the Section 1983 claim on the ground that there was no constitutional violation that had been adequately alleged. On appeal, the Fifth Circuit said, no, there is a constitutional violation at issue in Spiller, the Fourth Amendment right, but went ahead to dismiss the case on other grounds, specifically the lack of a policy. And the court went into a very good discussion about how an allegation of an official policy cannot be conclusory, it cannot be vague, and found that the Section 1983 claim was not valid because an official policy had not been alleged adequately by the plaintiff in that case. And that's certainly the case that we have here with the appellant's complaint. It's very, I would characterize as a bare bones complaint. There are not a lot of facts alleged in there, certainly nothing specific as to official policy or custom. The words policy and policymaker do not appear anywhere at all in the appellant's complaint.
Well, as I understand it, they're primarily relying on widespread practice.
And I think that's what they have to, Judge, because that's the closest they get in their complaint to meeting this requirement. They allege that the practice of disregarding the Advanced Directives Act was widespread within JPS. A few issues to note there. Mr. Vickers touched upon these. First of all is, in order for a custom of a governmental entity to give rise to a Section 1983 claim, it has to be so widespread as to practically have the force and effect of law, at least within the governmental unit. And folks within the governmental unit have to know that that's the policy and that's the policy that's followed in those situations. As Mr. Vickers pointed out, in giving deference to the plaintiff's pleading, attaches the anonymous email, which suggests that we're dealing with one physician, three patients over a one-month period, and that her actions were reported to the CEO of JPS by ICU nurses and that she was subjected to discipline. I see my time's up. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll turn it over to Mr. Taylor.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, rebuttal?
If it may please the court, I will address the arguments in reverse order. First, as to the issue raised by this being a right to medical care, as we said, this is not any right to general or expansive medical care. This is an end-of-life case involving unilateral decisions to commit passive euthanasia. However, if medical care were at issue, there is a special relationship involved. It is the parents patri relationship with incapacitated persons. This was recognized in both, both the majority and the dissent in Cruzan. It's also recognized, for instance, the TL versus Cook case. In fact, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals went so far there as to say that there is a relationship, parents-patri relationship with incapacitated persons, even in private hospital situations. But there is certainly a relationship when we are involving state-run hospitals. Couple of other things regarding the Bacco case, the Supreme Court's opinion and quotation thereof. If you'll take a look at that quotation, that specifically refers to patients who had asked or indicated that they wanted life support withdrawn. In those cases, the intent of the physician is to facilitate the wishes. It provides no support for the idea that a physician can do it unilaterally. And the Fort Worth Court of Appeals and TL versus Cook examined these cases and found the opposite, that VACO implicitly supported constitutional rights in this case. It further examined the other cases on which they rely in terms of the causing death versus letting a person die context. The court expressly rejected those and said they hardly supported the right of a physician to unilaterally terminate life. I'll just direct the court to the TL opinion for a further discussion of that. In terms of the pleading standards, the references to clear, specific, et cetera, as Judge Dennis are legacies of an earlier pleading standard, even though they sometimes appear in cases today. If you go through those cases and look at the sources, you'll find, as far as I can recall, they all stem back to pre-Leatherman cases. There's no requirement under 12b-6 that requires specificity of pleading, and there's certainly nothing that requires buzzwords like policy, policymaker, et cetera. The Supreme Court's made clear of that in cases such as Skinner and Johnson opinions cited in our briefs. Nor is there any requirement to make clear the capacity of the person, how a defendant is being sued.
You were given the opportunity to amend, is that correct?
There's always, I guess, a right under the rules for a person to seek leave to amend. You may be referring to the suggestion of this court, which is often followed in the Northern District, that if a court determines that pleadings are inadequate but might be cured, the judges of the Northern District frequently will allow opportunity to amend to correct the defects the judge believes exist. In other words, grananting the motion to dismiss without prejudice to a leave to amend. That did not occur in this case. And in fact, these issues were never addressed because the court instead, sua sponte, raised a different issue, the standing issue that I think everyone agrees was incorrect. That's a reason why perhaps this court may not want to examine these issues because they haven't been resolved by the district court in the first instance. And regardless of what the district court might have found, the strong possibility the court might have believe that these were any defects, if they existed, could have been cured by an amendment. However, don't believe we have any defects here. Regarding Duane's capacity, again, the rules expressly say there's no need to plead that at all. Instead, the Adrian case is not as Mr. Vickers described. In Adrian, the plaintiff expressly said the claims were in official capacity and then tried to reverse course later. That is not the case here, and I believe we've addressed that issue adequately in the briefing to the court. Finally, regarding the policymaker issue, as I say, this is simplified considerably here because we have the appearance of an official policy. And as I said, the court never ruled on these issues. And I believe this court can take into consideration the arguments by counsel at this stage. In fact, they may constitute judicial admissions that be considered. And I believe both Mr. Vickers and Mr. Garrett, on behalf of their clients, stated a belief that the requirements of due process of the Texas Advanced Directive Acts, et cetera, are all optional, are merely safe harbors, are not mandatory, et cetera. And so there's reason to believe that there is a formal, perhaps even written policy in which the same position is conveyed to nurses, for instance, leading them to believe that they must obey the directives of physicians, that even if they would otherwise violate the act. I see I'm out of time and cannot address further, but I'm happy to address any questions the court may have.
Thank you, counsel. We have your arguments.
Thank you very much.
The court will take a brief recess before hearing the third. Thank you.